Christy's having a class for kids. Luke chapter 16. We're going to be looking at verses 14 to 18. Last Sunday, Cole talked about verses 14 and 15, and I'm going to back up just to keep the continuity of the passage going. Hope you'll follow along with the outline. The title of the morning, this morning's message is The Art of Justifying Divorce and Adultery. Let's read our text, Luke chapter 16, begin reading verse 14. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all these things. This is the things that Jesus had just talked to his disciples about. And they were scoffing at him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. The law and the prophets were proclaimed until John, being John the Baptist. Since then, the gospel of the kingdom of God is preached, and everyone is forcing his way into it. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one stroke of a letter of the law to fail. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery." Four verses, and seems like every one of them have an issue that I would rather somebody else talk about. But here we are. We've come to this in our text, and so let's see what it says. Last week, Cole started at the very first verse of chapter 16, and Jesus talking to his disciples, our text tells us specifically, talking to them about the unjust steward and how that you need to be faithful in your stewardship and et cetera. When he gets through with that, our text says that the Pharisees had been listening to what he had to say, and they began to ridicule him or to mock him. And I don't know if they were doing this aloud or if it's just an expression on their face. The text doesn't tell us that. But it was enough that Jesus knew it, and probably they did it in such a way that everyone else around them knew that they disapproved of what Jesus had said. So Jesus responds to the Pharisees, and the rest of our text this morning is that response of Jesus to the Pharisees. And the first thing he says is this: "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men." Think of that phrase, justify yourself in the sight of men. What kind of person needs to do that? To justify themselves in the sight of men. Okay, a person whose behavior perhaps contradicts his words. All right? A person who is trying to convince probably himself as much as everybody else, but he knows there's something there in his life that he wants to keep hidden, and so he has to explain to everyone the why he is the way he is. He's got to justify his actions, got to justify his behavior before men so that they will approve of his life. So they will go, "Oh, okay, I see now." Jesus tells the Pharisees, "You are those type of people who justify yourselves, have to justify yourselves in the sight of men. But God," he says, "knows your heart." Do you think you can pull this stunt with God? Obviously not. You can't convince God you are one way when you are another. You can't justify your behavior before men or before God, because God knows the truth. God knows your hearts. Then the last phrase he says in verse 15 is this: that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. And this is true in a lot of areas of life, that there are a lot of things that impress the world, but they don't in the slightest impress God. He says those things that you are highly esteemed among yourselves and among the world, usually or at least sometimes, God finds them detestable. God hates them. God despises them. So we see here that a lot of times our ideas of what is good, our ideas of what is great, our ideas of what is glorious, and God's ideas are totally at odds with one another. So he tells the Pharisees this in verse 14. Then he gets to verse 15. And he says, the law and the prophets were proclaimed until John. Now this, and I've got the word written on here, do we have a dispensational transition here? And I use that word because I couldn't think of a better one, but I know that dispensation word can be a baggage-laden word to some extent. But he's talking about a time in God's process of God's plans, the process of God's program, or whatever you want to call it, that there is something that came that was until John the Baptist. He says it was the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets were until John, and since then, there's something that's different. And that something is that he says that the gospel of the kingdom of heaven is preached. Now, we might could get a little more specific of that transition time, and it may be when John was at the Jordan River baptizing, and Jesus came, and John points him out and says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. He who comes after me is preferred before me, and etc. It may be that that was the transition time, but Jesus points out that there was such a time when the law and the prophets, in some sense, were there until John, and since then the gospel of the kingdom is preached. And then he uses this phrase, and people forced their way into it. Now, what does that mean? I'm going to give you my guess. All right, I'm not positive of what that refers to, but I think it refers to in Jesus' day, there was a special outpouring of God's Spirit upon people, particularly common people. And people flocked to Jesus. And there were many times as we went through the book of Luke, we'll see it a number of more, where people were the crowds were so great around Jesus that he could barely maneuver. And there were times when he tried to intentionally get away from the crowds to be alone. Maybe it's that kind of idea that Jesus is talking about, that people are trying to force their way or press their way into the kingdom of God. Because God has moved upon their spirit, and they have a repentant spirit, and they are flocking out to John to begin with to be baptized and to find their way into the kingdom of the Messiah. Then we get to verse 17. For it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one stroke of the letter of the law to fail. God's law, he says, the law of God that God gave to Moses, for that to fail, for one tiniest portion of that law to fail and to not be true, it would be much easier for the heavens and the earth to pass away. Can you imagine? This is not a thing I've got written here. This is not just an exaggeration that Jesus is making to prove a point. It's literally true. It would be easier for the heavens and the earth to just totally disappear than for the one minute thing of the law of God to not come to pass or to be untrue. Jesus is making a profound statement about God's law. Now, why does he do that? He's talking to the Pharisees here. Why does he start making these comments about the law? And it's because the Pharisees are masters at manipulating the law. And I'm not sure if this next verse is connected to that in such a way or not, but the next verse talks about adultery. And he makes this statement, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery. Now, we're going to spend the rest of this morning talking about this verse. And I want to tell you up front, and I want you to make sure you hear this, that my comments are not designed to beat you over the head with anything in your past. I've got a past as well. And at times we have to face our past. We have to acknowledge that it exists. So my comments are not designed to beat you up with your past. My design this morning is to warn you about the potential things that could come in your future. And I'm not talking about kids. I'm talking about us. I don't care if you've been married 40 years or 50 years, there's potential for you to screw your life up in the area of divorce and adultery. All right, I've seen people that I wondered how in the world I would have never thought that their life would have turned that direction. But it did. And it can happen in a moment. All right, I want to read the comment that I've got on there, and I'd like for you to read it with me. Not aloud. My comments are made to warn you of potential danger ahead. Danger that you may bring upon yourself. Probably not with bold, deliberate intent, but with carelessness, with neglect, with poorly placed trust, with complacency, with neglect to nurture your soul, with having your mind saturated with a worldview that is contrary to the doctrines of the Word of God. With a gradual hidden attack on your soul, the enemy will have you in his snare before you realize what's going on. So, let's look at what this text says. First of all, we want to define these two words, adultery and marriage. Adultery, see my definition there. Adultery is sexual intimacy between a man and a woman when at least one of them is already married. Okay, let's say that again. Adultery, defined as sexual intimacy between a man and a woman when at least one of them is already married. Now, I've got a question for you here. If a married man and a married woman, of course, married not to each other, have their own spouse, a married man and a married woman have a sexual affair. Has adultery taken place? Yes. If so, by whom? The man and the woman, right? Okay. Ask you a second question. If a single man, a never married man, has a sexual affair with a married woman, has adultery taken place? By whom? Both. Okay, not just the married woman, but by both. All right? Glad you all tend to agree with that. I thought I was going to have to be hard-pressed to convince you of that. But that's the way, historically, the way this has been looked in the history of the United States. Used to be, you'd never know it by the actions of people, but used to be, adultery was illegal in the United States. And in most cases, it was considered adultery if a single man had an affair with a married woman or a single woman had an affair with a married man. She was or he was also considered an adulteress. All right, sins have, some sins are worse than others, right? Here, let's say you've got a single man and a single woman, they have sexual affair or intimacy. Is that a sin? Yes, it is. What if this single man doesn't have an affair with this single woman, but he has an affair with a married woman? Is that a worse sin than the first one? Yes, I think it is. Because he's not only sinning, it's not just the sexual sin, but now he has aided and abetted someone else to break their marriage covenant. Now he's got adultery added to his list. If a married man and a married woman both have an affair with one another, is that worse than just one of them? Yes. Because now not only has this man had an affair with a married woman, he's helped her to break the covenant of her marriage, but he's breaking his own. So his sin multiplies. Some sins are worse than others. Jesus said, if you look on a woman to lust after her, you've committed adultery with her already in your heart. Is that as bad as committing it in the flesh? No. It's still considered adultery, breaking the commandment of adultery, but it's not as bad as carrying out the act. Because there are a lot of things that come into play and effect when you act it out, and it's not just in your mind. So far, the woman hasn't committed a sin. It's just in your head. Okay, everybody kind of following the thought there? Some sins are worse than others. Marriage. Definition for marriage. Marriage is the union of a man and a woman into a lifelong covenant of sexual fidelity, faithfulness, love, and support. And you could find better words to put in there to describe that, I'm sure. Now, here's an important point. Marriage always assumes and implies sexual intimacy. When we say someone is married, you assume that sexual intimacy is taking place. Now, it may not be, but the assumption is that marriage assumes sexual intimacy. The Bible calls this, and it's not just this, but the idea of being one flesh with your spouse. All right? This came to the first time this is used is in Genesis chapter 2, where God says the man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. All right? He brings that up again, uses that phrase again in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 15 to 20. There is something, in fact, he talks about, uses this word in Ephesians chapter 5. There is something very mysterious about this one flesh principle. It is something very spiritual that God does when a man and woman marry and become one flesh. This is a unique and special bond between a man and a woman that takes place that should never be taken lightly. It should never be undone. It should never take place outside of marriage. It is a bond. Becoming one flesh is more than sexual intimacy, although it includes that. It is a union that is to be protected with all of our being. The marriage covenant is instituted by God, overseen by God, and should never have reason to be broken. The only place that sexual intimacy can righteously take place is within a marriage. Now I'm going to read a verse to you from 1 Corinthians chapter 7. If you want to turn there, you can. Verse 2, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 2. I'm going to read verse 1 to get the context a little bit. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife. Now, Paul says that to avoid immorality, one way to avoid this immorality is for a man to be married. What kind of immorality is it that a man can avoid by being married? Some of your translations may use something besides the word immoralities there, but because of immoralities. What kind of immorality could take place that being married might help you to avoid? Sexual sin. Sexual sin. To avoid sexual sins, God's solution to avoid sexual sins is to be married. All right, there are only two options as far as sexual intimacy. One is to be married, or the other is to abstain. Today, and it's not just in our day, it's been this way for dozens and dozens of years. Sexual intimacy is so common, and it is so pervasive outside of marriage, that when a man and woman who have been sexually intimate, if they split up, the emotional tearing apart and ripping apart of that union is such that it is no less than if they had been married and were going through a divorce. The tearing apart is that painful and is that great. This is not the way God planned it to be. This is not the way God wants your life or my life. So we kind of swing back around to this text and this context. Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, talking to the Pharisees about the law, and then he makes this statement. Whoever man divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. A man marries a woman who is divorced from her husband, he commits adultery. Now we look at that, and we want to say, yeah, but there are other things to consider. There are exceptions to the rule where divorce is wrong and divorce is adultery, equated with adultery. There are other things that Paul said, you remember, in 1 Corinthians 7, or Jesus said in Matthew 19. Jesus could have mentioned those things, but he didn't. So I'm not going to. We're not going to talk about the exceptions. We're not going to talk about the things that could be. Because Jesus doesn't here. Well, why doesn't he? I think it's, myself, I think it's because he's talking to these Pharisees, and the Pharisees are experts in justifying their behavior. They're experts in manipulating the law to say what they want it to say so that they can keep the law in the way that they want to keep it. And adultery was just one of the things. There was two school of thoughts along this regard in Jewish scholars. One is called the school of Shammai. And his view was, the most conservative view, that the only grounds for divorce was adultery. There was another school of thought by Hillel, and it had many grounds. In fact, this is just exactly like the day in which we live. It's called no-fault divorce. And this said that a man could divorce his wife if she burns his food, if she spoils his food, if she dared to talk disrespectful about his parents or his kinfolks, if she raised her voice enough that it was heard in the house next door, if she talked to a strange man, or if she spun in the street. Now, I don't know what spun in the street is. Maybe she is just acting a little bit too cheerful. I don't know. But let me give you another question. How is, in our day, how has this looked? Here's a man who's married, and him and his wife just fight like cats and dogs, and he's had enough of it, and so he gets a divorce. And he marries another woman. We don't know or we don't care for my intent whether she's been married or not. Let's say she's single. So here's a married man. He gets divorced from his wife because they can't get along, and he marries this woman. Has adultery taken place? Okay. Not as quick to answer on that one. All right. What does our verse say? If a man divorces his wife and marries another, he commits adultery. When, in this verse, when is it that he commits the adultery? When he divorces his wife? No. That's when he broke his marriage covenant. The context implies strongly, and I mean, I don't think anybody would deny that, that adultery is acknowledged when he marries another woman. We don't look at it that way in our world, do we? No. Spyros Zodiates explains this idea in this way, which I like his explanation, and it makes it a little more palatable, I guess, perhaps. But he says the idea, in fact, it's in the Greek word there, everyone who divorces his wife without cause. And Matthew 19, where Jesus makes a similar statement, it's said that way. It's mentioned that way. If you divorce your wife without cause and marry another, then that's adultery. In the Old Testament, Moses, the law was given there, then they would be a wife would be given a writ of divorcement. And that piece of paper was important to her. You remember what the punishment for adultery was in the Old Testament? You didn't need a piece of paper. You needed armor, suit of armor on. You're fixing to be killed. You're fixing to be stoned. But if a man divorced his wife and she was innocent, he could give her a writ of divorcement. And that writ of divorcement was acknowledging that she was innocent in this divorce. That she was innocent in the matter of adultery. And she was free to remarry, and people looked at her in a different light. But what if she didn't have one? If she was guilty, she didn't need one. She's fixing to be executed. But if her husband, and I can imagine this taking place, when people usually split up, they tend to not like each other that well. They tend to inflict as much harm on the other person as they possibly can and to make life miserable for the other person as much as they can. What if he says, forget you, I ain't giving you a writ of divorcement? What does the community think? She's guilty. She is viewed as an adulterer because she doesn't have this piece of paper. Now, those kind of things are kind of tied in, it seems like, with this verse that Jesus gives. And the reason I think that he gives this to the Pharisees is because the Pharisees, like many people in the United States, are looking for a way to justify their behavior. They have an exception, and they expand that exception all that they can. An unfaithful wife, it's okay to divorce your wife. If she's unfaithful, well, burning breakfast is a sign of unfaithfulness or whatever. Now, a couple things right here at the end that I want to go through. And I'm not going to give you grounds for divorce. I'm going to give you things that are not grounds for divorce. All right? If you're going to write them down, you're going to have to probably do it pretty quick. Here's one. My marriage is not what I expected, so I'm going to get divorced. That's not grounds for divorce. Just because your marriage is not what you thought it was cut out to be, I guarantee you no one's is. All right? The day you get married, you have high expectations, and you cannot for the life of you see what could possibly go wrong. But it does, and fairly quickly. But because your life is not what you expect it to be, because marriage is not what you expect it to be, that is not grounds for divorce. The second one, you are unhappy in your marriage. And you think you will be unhappy for the rest of your life. That is not grounds for divorce. I remember years ago, getting a haircut, and this lady that's cutting my hair was also in the middle of getting a divorce, apparently, or thinking about it, and her partner or whoever, the other lady that's cutting hair, they both cut hair in the same building, so they're having this conversation, and I'm just like a fly on the wall, you know, just listening, and the other lady was Dear Abby, you know, she's giving her all this great advice on how to handle all this. And she made this statement. She said, you know, you just got to do what makes you happy. Perhaps I had enough sense to keep my mouth shut. Maybe it's because she had scissors and my ear was right there. I'm not sure, but I didn't say a word. But I thought, what a fool. What a fool. Got to do what makes you happy. If you follow that advice every time, you will discard your children before they're 2 years old. All right? You'll discard your spouse before you have time to have children. All right? There are plenty of times in your life you are not going to be happy. Being happy is not ground, or unhappy is not grounds for divorce. Being unhappy for a long time is not grounds for divorce. The next one, you want divorce because you're always poor, always short of money. All right, you always have more bills than you have money, and you're tired of it. It just ought not to be this way. And there's always a reason why it's that way that, of course, is not your fault. That's not grounds for divorce. Being poor is not grounds for divorce. Being very poor is not grounds for divorce. Here's the next one. Y'all don't look at me when I say this. Your spouse has become obese or ugly or stinks or loses their teeth or whatever. They're just unattractive. And the world gives you a flood of attractive people options to look at instead. And that's enough. You've had enough of this thing. And so you want to get divorced. That is not grounds for divorce. Your spouse lacks motivation to get ahead. Some people are highly motivated to produce and be productive and to make something out of their life, and other people not so much. Well, that rears its ugly head the most when a husband is not a very motivated person, has very little initiative, but his spouse, his wife, does. That is a butting ahead, butting together of heads there that is hard to reconcile. But it's not grounds for divorce. Here's another one. You provide for your stepchildren, but aren't allowed to discipline them. That's a hard one. All right? You buy their food, you pay their electricity, you do all these things, but the first time you lift your hand to discipline them or to talk to them, your wife, these are my kids, not your kids. That kind of scenario. That might be the case, but it's not grounds for divorce. Your spouse has a drinking or a drug problem. That's a hard one. A drinking or a drug problem. The Bible never says that's grounds for divorce. Now, let me just make one pause. I know there are situations that can be so severe and so dangerous to your physical well-being that you need to be apart from this spouse. I understand that. But we're not talking about that bad. We're not talking about exceptions, remember? Just because someone has a drug problem or a drinking problem, nowhere in the scriptures can you find that and show me that that's grounds for divorce. Your spouse doesn't share your faith. I thought we were on the same page there, that we both were Christians, but it's obvious that my husband or my wife is not a Christian. And no amount of nagging that I do to try to point that out to them works. Or I'm a Mormon and she's a Jehovah's Witness, and we thought that would work out, but it ain't working out. All right? That may be the case, but it's not grounds for divorce. And eventually, here's what happens. You begin to wish that your spouse would mess up so that you would have grounds for divorce that were undeniable. You begin to wish you could catch them. You suspect it already, but you begin to wish you knew it for a fact so you would feel good about filing for divorce. Or you begin to wish that your spouse would file for divorce so they look like the bad one. Isn't that true? I ain't going to ask if anybody ever had those thoughts, but I guarantee you there are plenty of people who have. You know that you're going to go against your conscience to file for divorce, so you hope he would or she would. So you can benefit from their sin. At least that's what your conscience would tell you. And in doing all these things, we play the part of the Pharisee and we practice our art of justifying our divorce. Let's go on to the next one, justifying walking down the path to, what's the word I've got on there? Bliss? What?
Personal fulfillment.
I've got a different outline than y'all do. I knew it was different on that word anyway. Walking down the path of personal fulfillment. What do you see the word in a little bitty print? Adultery. All right? You're going to call it personal fulfillment, but in reality it's adultery. You don't want to use that word. All right? Here's how some of the time this can play itself out in a lot of ways. But you notice someone. You notice someone of the opposite sex that is much nicer to you generally than your spouse is. And you appreciate that. And you find yourself enjoying being around them. That ought to wave a big red flag right there. And your thoughts ought to go to the proverb. It says, guard your heart with all diligence. Because at any point in your marriage, any point all the way through, you can find somebody that's nicer than your spouse in one certain area. And when your heart begins to think this and your mind begins to go do this and you realize that, and you find yourself hoping I see them tomorrow, let a flag go off and guard your heart with all diligence. You orchestrate events so that you are able to cross paths with this person. There are thoughts that you have and your appreciation of this person. Maybe it's not sexual thoughts, but it's just thoughts of enjoying being with them that you have, and you know you would not want your spouse know you were having those thoughts. That ought to set a red flag off. Guard your heart with all diligence. You convince yourself that this person is your soulmate, whatever that is. Anybody tell me what a soulmate is? It's supposed to be something like somebody that's made just for you. God made one person just for you. That's your soulmate. And you're on your fifth one already. Right? That's about how much sense that makes. They're your soulmate until you take their guts and then you find another one and only soulmate. You put distance between you and your friends who you know might question your behavior. If I've got friends, I don't need to use myself as an example, but if a person who is doing this and they know they're doing it and they just am not stopping themselves, they're not guarding their heart, and they know they've got friends who they suspect will be able to recognize this in them, they tend to avoid those friends for fear they're going to be exposed as to what's going on. You make new friends who encourage you to do what makes you happy, like the hairdresser. You find someone who will be a yes man for you and agree with you and say, yes, that's what you need to do. And you find yourselves hanging out with them and listening to their advice and their counsel. You convince yourself that long term, this will be best for your children. And that perhaps is the biggest lie you will believe. Maybe so, maybe not. I grew up in a home. My mom and dad were married when they were 18 years old, I believe. They had three kids. My older sister, 2 years older than me, then my younger sister is 8 years younger than me. Three kids. My dad came from a Christian home. They didn't read a lot of psychology books. They probably never had to go to a therapist or anything like that, or a counselor. They lived a hard, working, rough life. Not rough in the sense of abusive or sinful. Just life was hard, and they were poor. But it was a Christian home. So my dad had somewhat of a foundation for himself. My mother's family was not that way. My grandma was married, had 5 kids. Her husband died. She remarried, who happened to be my grandpa, second husband. They had 4 kids. And I grew up in my childhood in an era, at least it was an era around the county or the area of the country that we lived in, was southeast Arkansas, in an era where people did not talk about things, especially to their kids. You just didn't talk about it. I knew my mom's folks were rough, but we never got to go down there without my dad being there. All my cousins would come for a couple weeks every summer, and all those cousins would camp out and sleep out together in the yard at the old schoolhouse where my grandparents lived. All of them, except us. And we lived a quarter of a mile or less down the road. I didn't really know why. I knew my aunt had 2 or 3 kids. Every one of them had a different last name. I didn't really grasp what that meant. And it was not until I got grown that I began to hear little bits of information from mostly my dad, talking about what either they knew to be the case or what they suspected to be the case of abuse, sexual abuse from, there's 9 kids. My mother's oldest siblings, were 10 or 20 years old or 15 or 20 years older than her. So, by the time she was 10 or 12 years old, they were 18 to 20. My grandpa had some brothers that would come down, and a lot of the little tidbits of information I heard had something to do with those brothers and my mom's older sisters. I don't know what my mom experienced. I don't know if she was abused or molested. I don't know if she wasn't, but just saw things that as a kid she should never have seen. I don't know. But I know, and didn't realize this until I was grown, that my mom and dad's relationship was far from ideal. And for the most part, I suspect it was far from ideal sexually. I would imagine that in most homes, their marriage would not have lasted. As far as I know, neither one of them was unfaithful to the other. It's
for me and my sisters, all three of us, the thought of my dad being unfaithful to my mom was laughable. We would never believe it. Not because we want to protect my dad, just because we know him. What could have been a home destroyed was not. You know, I have never, not one time in my whole life, have I thought my mom and dad might split up. Never. It never crossed my mind. They might, could have. And they might, if they had been so self-centered and so selfish of their own desires, our home ended up that way. But they didn't. They stayed together. They kept their marriage covenant. And there are three kids that are glad.
I'm looking at mostly married couples here. Some of you have been married for 50 or 60 years. Susan and I have been married for 44 in August. If I think that our marriage is not capable of going astray and falling into all these traps, if I think that's beyond us, I'm a fool. It is. We are capable of slipping away gradually. And eating ourselves up with contempt for one another. And finding someone else who meets all of our needs, supposedly. We are capable of doing that. So are you. I don't care how old you get. This message is to warn you. Guard your heart with all diligence. Guard your marriage with all diligence. Do not slack off and disregard your marriage covenant as something that you can take or leave, or something that has no meaning or no value. Are you with me? Let's do it.